This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And hello, Hearts of Oak. Thank you so much for joining us on a sweltering Monday evening here in the UK, and we're doing this just 2 hours before with Ben Harris Quinney. Ben, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Good to be with you.
Now, we are going to look at the, from the outside, the supposed kind of chaotic scene over the last week, and you'll shed some light on that in the Conservative Party, Boris resigning, and what on earth is what's next, I guess, for the Conservative Party. But before I jump in, let me just bring up Ben's details. Ben obviously has been with us before, and Ben is the chairman of the world's oldest conservative think tank, the Bo Group, and you can follow the Bo Group on Getter and on Twitter at Bo Group and at Harris Quinney, also on Getter, or if you're still on Twitter, then at B_HQ. You can follow Ben on Twitter, and I would encourage you to do that over the next couple of weeks. If this is a topic that you're interested in with the Conservative Party and this leadership race, then do make sure and add Ben onto your list of people to follow, as he will bring you the most up-to-date information that is currently happening. Now, Ben, can I just ask your thoughts? Because obviously last week, we'll just touch on that where we are. We had probably Tuesday, suddenly with Rishi Sunak and with Sajid Javid resigning. Maybe you want to touch on that, because for the viewers, probably many of them who are not into politics thought, well, you had the vote of no confidence in the Conservative Party, Boris survived that. Many people outside of the political bubble probably thought that actually he was going to then sail on for the next year. So something happened. Can you maybe just let us know what your thoughts are on kind of how last week transcribed?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the first instance, I think we'd got to a point where Boris had just about weathered all of the scandals that had come out previously. You know, there are almost too many to list, but Partygate, Wallpapergate, the scandals really centering around the goings on in Number 10 and the drama there that was flowing between Boris and his girlfriend and then later wife, Carrie, Dom Cummings, in a way that hadn't been seen before. Yeah. There's always been a soap opera of politics, but the soap opera of the Downing Street flat wasn't really a feature of our politics in our history, really. So that had become a scandal factory, and Boris had just about survived all of those scandals. But I think there was a general feeling, you know, with that vote of no confidence, that the next one would be the straw that broke the camel's back. And of course, it then came out about Christopher Pincher having groped two men at the Carlton Club. But more significantly, that Christopher Pincher's behaviour has been known about in Westminster. Mm-hmm. I knew about it. I think everyone in Westminster knew about it, and many others also, for a decade or more. And yet Boris had put him forward for a very senior government post in Deputy Chief Whip. And the argument was that Boris knew about all of these concerns, which he denied, and it later transpired that that was a lie. And so that became a new scandal in and of itself. And I think most people within and without the Conservative Party felt that, you know, that was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. When Sunak and Javid resigned together, it was very clear that they were going for a quote-unquote quick kill strategy, because... Yeah. If they weren't working in unison, or if that wasn't the plan, they would have spread out their resignations. But they timed it both together to obviously be the most prominent resignations in what would become a slew of resignations over the coming days. And so it was, I think, hitting record numbers of approximately 60 MPs resigning from government posts, ministerial posts, trade envoy posts. And what that really meant was that Boris Johnson just didn't have enough people left in order to form a government with. And of course, famously, then over the period of 24 hours, the people that he had appointed to replace those resigning in the form of the Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi, Education Secretary Michel Donnellan, both indicated that they also felt that he should go. So his position had become untenable. And whilst that leadership election, the challenge to his position that had occurred previously that he won, held the rule that you couldn't have another one within another year, the 1922 committee indicated that they would change the rules to allow that to happen if he didn't step down. So it had become a fait accompli. He either went, of his own accord, or he would be ejected.
Can I ask you, because there are two sides to Boris. There is the side that I guess those in the UK see and the side that those abroad see. And I think those abroad maybe have a more favourable view of him. He's this character. He's getting Brexit done. That's kind of how the conversation I have with some of my US friends. And I see that your pinned tweet, and I don't know whether you're prophetic or not, but your pinned tweet is, mark my words, Carrie Simmons and Boris Johnson are on course to become one of the biggest soap opera train wrecks in British history. And that was 21st of June 2019, so just over 3 years ago. Do you just want to let us know why you think that, especially for our non-UK audience who may not have that same insight?
Certainly, yes. I mean, I don't claim that to be a prophecy. I merely know the character of both individuals. So Carrie Johnson, then Simmons, is someone who was involved in the Tatler Tory scandal, which was a scandal that I exposed in 2015 after the Conservative Party officials threatened me and many others. I was specifically threatened to stop writing about the Westminster paedophile scandal and party democracy, which I was told that if I did not do that, I would be smeared in the press. I refused to stop writing about it. And so they smeared me in the press, and then we exposed this scandal. And at the time, Carrie Simmons was head of broadcast media at CCHQ and was involved in a lot of the smear campaign that went on. So she was a figure that I was very much aware of. She then left Conservative Central Office under accusations of fiddling her expenses and workplace bullying. And so, it was very clear that she was someone that was involved in politics and very aspirational, and not a particularly nice piece of work and willing to engage in dirty tricks and that kind of thing. And I think when you get a combination of someone like that in the role of Prime Minister's wife or girlfriend, it's pretty clear that they're not going to be happy to just concern themselves with, what's bringing up the children and the private life side of things. Clearly, there is a desire there to get involved in politics. And of course, that's unconstitutional because, if someone is sleeping with the prime minister or marrying the prime minister in order to further their own political career and have influence on our politics, there's no mechanism here for that. We don't even have a first lady system that has their own government post. So really, the prime minister's wife or girlfriend should have absolutely nothing to do with policy or hiring staff in Number 10 or anything like that. On the Boris side, Boris is an avowed liberal. His personal life is clearly immensely chaotic, and I think Boris could have worked or can work if he had recognised the strength of feeling that was behind Brexit, recognised what those Brexit voters wanted and what the people that voted for him in 2019 wanted, and had someone alongside him that was a detail-oriented figure and very committed to that agenda. But the situation that ended up was one that as I said in my tweet, that you had a co-prime ministerial role, Boris being a liberal, Carrie being, I think, more left-wing, very much committed to net zero and the woke agenda. And Dom Cummings sort of, for a while, fell in between that and tried to advance an agenda, but then, as reports suggest, was ultimately forced out by Carrie. And that meant, you know, that you didn't even have anyone to moderate that approach. And I think both in policy terms and in terms of the way that Downing Street was being run, and frankly, the way that people were behaving within Downing Street with the parties and so forth, and the youth culture that developed there, I think was the reason that, that Boris Johnson's premiership fell apart.
If I, one last historical question before we get on to where we are right at this current time, probably have to go back to probably IDS Ian Duncan Smith, I would think, for a leader who was conservative, in socially conservative, but also wanted small government, low tax, wanted the government to butt out of our lives. But he was never prime minister. So you probably have to go back to Margaret Thatcher, and she resigned in 1990. So for you, being kind of part of the Conservative Party, that being part of your, I guess, political ideology, how does that, you have to go back over 30 years then for on when we last had a Conservative prime minister that was actually conservative? Is that a fair comment?
It is, and from my position personally, I let my Conservative Party membership lapse in 2013 over same-sex marriage, and I probably shouldn't have even been a member then, but I certainly haven't renewed it since or saw fit to do so. From the Bow Group point of view, we have a lot of, the Bow Group is a small C conservative organization, and we have a great many people that are involved in the Conservative Party, many conservative MPs involved. And those conservative MPs, we feel represent the values of conservatism and therefore the values of the Bow Group. But over the last few decades, that pendulum has shifted ever more and more and more. So I would say now the majority of Conservative MPs do not represent those values. And they are either sort of atheist political careerists, or they are liberals. And some of them are frankly, you know, outright left-wingers. And I think that was one of the things that the Brexit vote and process exposed, that it forced a new dividing line through politics. And it became very clear that a lot of people in the Conservative Party were not remotely conservative. Some of them left, you know, people like Anna Soubry, Michael Heseltine, but many of them still remain. The problem is that the Conservative Party membership, and more crucially, the Conservative Party voters, are still very much small C conservatives. Back Brexit in very strong numbers, whereas Parliament was 75% Remain. The Conservative Party membership is about 70% pro-Brexit, but also have very strong feelings on many other issues, like social conservatism, like taxation, like national debt, fiscal conservatism. And what happened in 2019, I think, with Boris, was a lot of those voters that had long left the Conservative Party, and the Brexit referendum pulled them back into the political fray, felt that maybe with Boris there is someone who's learned the lesson, who's going to break the Cameron May Blairite trend. And I think the biggest tragedy probably of all this is that those people now feel terribly betrayed, and I would imagine that the majority of them will never vote again because of that betrayal.
I think I'm kind of in that bracket, having voted Boris. I mean, I have a, I think 2012 back Boris for London Mayor t-shirt in my cupboard. But I remember voting Boris, as many people, in 2019 because it would get Brexit done. That obviously hasn't transcribed into what we expected. But do you think it is possible, looking at where we are now, for the Conservative Party to have a reset on what it means for them and whether they are able, I guess, to reconnect back with Conservative voters. How do you see the next kind of 6 weeks, the summer period, going regarding that, I guess, tension within the party itself?
Well, as we speak, the 1922 committee are deciding the terms of the election.
The parliamentary ruling body that makes the rules for these things, just for our US viewers.
Yeah, so that's a body within Parliament that represents backbench Conservative MPs predominantly, although technically represents all Conservative members of Parliament. And they decide on the terms essentially that are going to govern Conservative MPs, and then they put those terms to the Conservative Party's National Convention as a whole, and that then forms the rules that govern the Conservative Party. And in this case, we don't have set rules like in America, where you know there's a primary system and everyone knows how it's going to be conducted. The rules are different each time, and ultimately they can choose whatever rules they want, which I think is extremely undemocratic and frankly ludicrous in a modern democracy of 65 million people. You know, two out of our last four prime ministers were selected rather than elected. You know, they were selected in sort of backroom horse trading deals. And so unfortunately, we don't know the result of that meeting. Conservative MPs are completely tin-eared to what the membership and what the voters want. So they want to be able to decide who the next prime minister is rather than having much of a public say on the issue. What we are campaigning for is to have a full primary before the Conservative Party membership, and to have that take place over months rather than weeks, in order that people can properly scrutinise candidates' policy proposals. Because a major reason why we're going to have had four Conservative leaders and four Conservative prime ministers in little over a decade is because none of those candidates were properly scrutinised, and none of them stuck to what the members and the voters wanted. So I think it's even more urgent now and even more important now that process includes maximum scrutiny and detail, and that whoever wins that race has a mandate, a democratic mandate, and a base that genuinely supports them to go forward, because otherwise we're just going to have another psychodrama in 2.5 years or so, when the Conservative Party fails again, and another Conservative government fails, and there's another leadership election. So we encourage the Conservative Party to learn the lesson of the past and to trust democracy. They won't, however. They'll go for a stitch-up, and it'll be a disaster. And then maybe I'll come back and you can call me a prophet again. But I'm not a prophet. It's just very basic and obvious to anyone who pays attention to these things.
Is the rush to select a new leader, and they've talked about doing it within weeks, so they talked about actually doing it by the time Parliament rises, I think on the 21st, that they'll have whittled it down to two. And then is the rush simply because Boris has remained in that position? Would it have been better if someone else, like the Deputy Prime Minister, whether he took on the position and then that gave more breathing space? How would you prefer the process up to now to have been done?
Well, look, we have a prime minister that was duly elected. I think it's rather extraordinary that a lot of the people that are running for this leadership are saying, oh, we Boris needs to be out ASAP. Yet a minute ago, they were serving in Boris's cabinet and telling us all how we needed to support him. The idea that they didn't know what Boris was like or what was going on in Number 10 or even what Chris Pincher was like is absolutely ludicrous. Anyone in politics, anyone that reads the news knows that. So the idea that there's a sudden panic that we need to get rid of Boris Johnson, I think, is churlish. Even if that was the case and there was some, you know, genuine security risk of Boris Johnson remaining in that post, then that's why we have a deputy prime minister in the form of Dominic Raab, and he can step into that role and govern until such time as the Conservative Party can have a proper democratic process. I think the idea that, oh, this needs to be done very quickly in the interests of stability is complete nonsense, because surely the interests of stability are best served by having a prime minister with a proper democratic mandate that has a base behind them, and that can go forward in government without having these, you know, constant internal battles. If the the issues and the conversations in the Conservative Party in the country as a whole are not properly aired, and there aren't proper detailed policy solutions to those issues, then it will clearly be a disaster. I mean, quite frankly, it takes longer to hire a middle manager. It takes longer to hire a cleaner in Britain than a couple of weeks. And yet we're choosing the person that leads the country in that period of time. It's just absolutely ludicrous. And I think most modern democracies would look on and think, you know, how is this the case in 2022 in Britain?
Let me bring up, this is the Daily Mail. These are the individuals at the moment in order of, I guess, bookies' favourite. You've got Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss, Nadeem Zahawi, Grant Shapps, Suella Braverman, Kemi Badenoch, Sajid Javid, Jeremy Hunt, Penny Mordaunt, Tom Tugendhat, Priti Patel, who I don't think has announced yet, and Remen Chishti, who I actually didn't know about. So those are the, what are your thoughts on what these candidates bring? It's obviously early days, although the process, as you said, is probably going to be quite quick, and different candidates have been backed by different MPs. What are your thoughts as you kind of look over the field of individuals who put themselves forward?
I think it reflects the depressing reality of the modern Conservative Party, and you know what you were saying, that it hasn't actually been conservative for a very, very long time. I think there are a number of candidates there who have the minor potential, I think, to take things back to proper small C conservative values that would be popular with the electorate. But unfortunately, those are the candidates that will be less favoured by a very quick election with a very high necessity for parliamentary colleague support. And that's exactly why that will be the case, that the establishment wants another establishment candidate. So they will favour people that really won't change anything, quite frankly. I mean, the conversation at the moment is, oh, I might cut tax by 1%, or, you know, fiddle about at the you know, the sidelines. But what Brexit demanded was a revolution in Westminster. That's what Boris was supposed to deliver. He hasn't delivered. And the idea that Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss is going to deliver that, I think, is for the birds. It's very frustrating for us in the Bow Group, because people do want to believe. And with each, even with Theresa May, it was the case early on in her premiership that people were calling her the next Margaret Thatcher. The new Iron Lady was the front page of the Daily Mail. With David Cameron, the same. People wanted to believe that he was going to be the saviour of conservatism and mark a significant change to Blair and end mass immigration and many of the Blair policies that we still have in place. And of course, Boris was the ultimate and latest betrayal in that line. So that revolution is still pending. If the Conservative Party don't deliver it, they will have a groundhog day of these internal crises, because what the people in Westminster want is different from what the voter base wants. And unfortunately, yeah, I see very few candidates in that lineup that could deliver that. And especially if the terms of the election are a stitch up, it's just going to be a choice between the same old people, and therefore you'll get the same old results.
To me personally, if I was looking at them, I would be thinking which ones actually took away our civil liberties during the pandemic, which ones actually fought for our rights as individuals, as freedom people, to actually live our lives as we want, and who would be rushing to lock us down. And also the whole, my other one, which is a massive one at the moment, is the whole, especially the trans debate. And all these MPs have served in, I think more, they've all been, I think, ministers more or less at different levels, some junior, some senior, but they've all been, they've all watched as our I guess, culture has collapsed in regards to the whole woke agenda, as you say. So, I mean, how do you look at it? How will the members, how will the MPs look at this, and how will they decide? Is it simply, as you said, 1p off basic rate tax or VAT being cut at the fuel pumps? Because to me, that really isn't enough and doesn't represent Conservative policies.
Well, they want the debate to be around should we lower tax by 1% or not, because that's a very dry debate and there's no real change being talked about there. What's happened in Britain over the last 12 years is that the woke agenda has become ubiquitous across every institution, across government, across the media. And the fact is, if it isn't challenged, if the culture war is not fought, then the result will be inevitable. And the idea that cutting 1% in fuel duty is more important than that is obviously ludicrous. So, as I say, what is required is a revolutionary, someone that is going to end the Blair years decisively and fight these battles. In terms of all the issues you mentioned, there's a few more I would add to that, but there's no one that ticks all of those boxes, because there are people who are better on the taking on the LGBTXYZ plus 44 lobby, but they don't have a particularly good track record. I'm thinking someone like Suella Braverman on things like vaccine passports, and then there are other figures who opposed things like vaccine passports who were at the dispatch box saying trans women are women. So, I mean, that's the problem. The rot is so deep in the Conservative Party that there isn't anyone who can really tick all the boxes in terms of the most basic Conservative values. The most basic values of logic and reality. What is a woman? So it's a weak field in that sense. And in terms of our support, people have been in touch with the Bow Group, but in terms of our support, the only conditions that we would support a candidate is under which they repudiated some of the things that they'd done in the past and explained them. And of course, even if they do that, you've still got the concern as to whether to trust them because of the amount of betrayal there's been in the past, and the fact that people promise a lot of things and then they get into power and don't do them. But I think, probably a candidate like Suella Braverman best represents small C conservative views and values. But again, I return to the point that she probably doesn't stand a chance under a stitch-up election. So we're probably talking about, Liz Truss versus Rishi Sunak or something entirely underwhelming like that.
I would love Kemi Badenoch and watching her in City Hall and then going there, but she's still a new MP and you need to understand how the machinery works, I think, to take on that position of power. But as you said, it's
Well,
frightening
I
because.
don't know. I mean, just briefly on that point, this sort of idea has gone along in British politics for a very long time that, oh, well, you have to have been a cabinet minister in order to accede to the role of prime minister. But I think things are changing, and I think things have so obviously gone very, very wrong over the last few decades. So actually, an outsider is probably exactly what we need. I think our swamp is in much greater need of drainage than anywhere else in the world. That was, of course, Trump's rallying cry going into Washington. But we need someone who is actively disliked in Westminster, I think, someone who is going to turn the tables over, because someone that's particularly been in a senior cabinet position, not only are they tarred with the same brush as what has gone before them, there's going to be little sense that they have a genuinely outsider perspective, and that's what's needed most.
I guess the last in 2019, was it June 2019, that Boris was a galvanizing figure. And there was excitement because he supposedly was the one who was destined to be leader. he has failed spectacularly on many issues. What does that mean for this race? Because again, when you tick all the boxes for what you want as a candidate and you're left with zero because no one actually fills that, what does that mean for Conservative members, for their engagement and involvement?
Well, it over the last few decades, the role of Conservative members in the Conservative Party democratically has been diluted and diluted and diluted. And the fact is, the Conservative Party hate and are embarrassed by their members, by my reading, because they see, you know, Theresa May stood up and called them the nasty party.
Yeah.
You know, they see their members as having out of date views, when actually it is the views of the members, had they listened to them, that would have delivered them much better electoral results. You know, Cameron's whole pitch was, well, we've got to move to the centre left because that's where the country is. And of course, he delivered hung parliaments and very anemic majorities. And then when Boris embraced the Brexit agenda, which really was the invention of, I mean, many people going back into the 90s, but the greatest champion was Nigel Farage. And that won them the biggest majority since Thatcher. You know, small C conservatism, patriotism wins elections. And those are the views that by majority you get in the Conservative Party membership. But those are the views that the Conservative Party establishment, Conservative campaign headquarters, and anyone who's been leader in recent memory have not wanted to hear. And what we hear in the Bow Group time and time again is, why is the Conservative Party playing to people who will never vote for them and ignoring the people that have put them in power? That's a question we still need an answer to. And the fact is, it's in the Conservative Party's own interests to reverse its position, because if they don't, we've seen over the last three leaders and three prime ministers that running against the interests of your base simply does not work. You will get brought down in the end because the left will never accept you. They'll keep attacking you. And what happened with Boris, what happened with May, what happened with Cameron is the right turned on them and they were attacked from both sides. No one can survive that.
Obviously, for those not in the UK, you need to remind them the Conservative Party have got a big majority, 80-seat majority. So does that mean then that whoever gets in charge, they have over 2 years to actually connect with the voters and do something conservative? How do you see those 2 years kind of working against someone who's incapable of any leadership, which is Keir Starmer?
To be honest, I think it will be a disaster the next 2 years. What we are seeing with the people that voted conservative in 2019 is not a switch over to Keir Starmer for reasons that anyone that knows Keir Starmer will find obvious. It's a return to not voting at all. You know, so many of those people that turned out in the Brexit referendum had stopped voting. And that was the great victory of the Brexit campaign, in that the Remain campaign didn't even think those people existed or weren't interested that they existed. And they'd stopped voting because we have a first past the post system and we have no genuine primary system in the UK. They just felt that, well, our votes don't count, so there's no point wasting the time of going down to the polling booth. In the referendum, because it was done in that way that a simple majority won and every vote counted, those people were suddenly re-enfranchised, and Boris conned them into thinking that he had learned the lesson and represented their interests. Those people, as I say, have not switched to Labour. They've gone back to that position of, well, there's no point in voting. And under those circumstances, Labour have a genuine chance of not necessarily winning outright, but forming a piecemeal coalition with the Lib Dems, the Greens, the SNP, and sort of forming a loser's charter, if you like. But from the Conservative Party point of view, I think they'll appoint another dud non-conservative candidate, and they will do so in a time when we're heading into a very serious recession. We're already in a very serious cost of living crisis, and many of the failures of the last few decades are coming to bloom. You know, no control over our borders, national debt that's running at over 100% of GDP, so we're effectively bankrupt as a nation. highest taxes in 70 years and an economic crisis. So I don't see anything in that lineup of conservative leaders that suggests to me that there's going to be someone capable of turning that round in 2 years. And so in 2 years, I think we're going to limp into another hung parliament situation. And very sadly, another situation where people just haven't learnt the lesson of Brexit, and we have the same old Blairite candidates singing the same old tune while the country circles down the pan.
Ben, you obviously understand the issues the country faces. You understand the issues that the Conservative Party faces. You understand the policies that would be needed. If you were doing your list, what would kind of be your three or four things that you think needs to be in the intro of a Conservative leader for them to actually do something for the country?
Well, I think number one, you've got to fight the culture war. Andrew Breitbart said that politics is downstream culture, not economics. And I think that's right. And even if you are one of these Tufton Street people that are only interested in, you know, taxes being lowered and have a sort of laissez-faire, do what thou wilt approach to society, the fact is that the people that are behind the Extinction Rebellion, the people that are behind Stonewall, the people that are behind BLM, what underwrites everything they're doing is a full-blown Marxist revolution. So if these people and their ideas get into power, they're not just going to attack on a cultural line. They're going to attack on an economic line as well. So that's the biggest battle facing the country. And actually, in Parliament on Wednesday, the Bow Group has Anne Widdecombe giving a major speech on that being the next big fight post Brexit. So in a leader, I'd want to see someone who's willing to fight that fight and who, you know, knows what a woman is and understands that these things are fundamental attacks on our civilization and way of life, and need to be fought back against hard. Number two, I've been talking for a very long time about national debt and the fact that the Western economy has become a Ponzi scheme, and all that has really occurred over the last few decades is the government has borrowed and printed more and more and more money. And that is why we have an inflation crisis. When the Conservatives came in 2010, they said that their main purpose was getting the deficit and the debt under control. Well, they've tripled the national debt since 2010. And I don't think we can believe that Labour are going to come in and do any better or sort it out. So there needs to be someone who is an Iron Chancellor, really, that's going to come in. What we recommend is making 250 billion in cuts that don't affect the lives and livelihoods of British people, things like HS2, things like international aid, and then using those cuts to get ahead of the borrowing schedule, so the government no longer needs to borrow to keep the country running, and is not then going to be caught up in another debt spiral like we saw in 2008, where the cost of just servicing the debt becomes the most expensive part of government expenditure. I think it's at about 83 billion now, and that's just the interest we're paying on the debt. If things carry on by next year, that will be the biggest area of government expenditure, and you know, again, you're heading for national bankruptcy down that route. So that would be the number two thing. And then, you know, if you can get that under control, you can start to cut taxes and engender growth. The third point I would say is democratization. The Brexit Party turned into the Reform Party because it recognized that whilst we achieved Brexit, what happened after that demonstrated how out of touch our electoral system and our institutions were with the British public. So I think we need reform to the House of Lords to turn that into a democratically elected body. I think we need a primary system, so the people are in charge of selecting the candidates, not people in Conservative Central Office or Labour HQ or whatever party it is. And I think that would completely revitalise democracy in Britain. And I think we need to look at the first past the post system and how you can have a situation where you know, parties can be getting a huge amount, some parties can be getting a huge amount of votes and not returning any MPs, and other parties like the SNP can be getting roughly the same amount of votes and returning an awful lot of MPs. I also think there is a very strong case now for an English parliament and an English legislative body that focuses just on England. So those are all really big questions that, that kind of stream in and out of the British Bill of Rights that we've also been talking about, and also touch on the points that you were talking about, really, which is civil liberties and the things that we consider sacrosanct as citizens, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and of course our right to decide our own fate. And what we saw in recent years, I think, very quickly, you know, with things like vaccine mandates, was really quite chilling. And I've been having these conversations about civil liberties for a very long time. And I think most people took the view in previous years, oh, but, you know, there's no real threat to freedom of speech. There's no real threat to personal individual liberty. And it's very clear how quickly that can change. Yeah. Unless those points aren't robustly defended in something like a Bill of Rights, but also in our political figures and in our national debate. So those are the things that I think are most important. But so many things have been neglected that we could be here all night talking about things that need to be reformed. You know, agriculture, British farmers, fisheries. The list is endless.
And we don't have all night, but I think on that we will finish up. But Ben, you mentioned the event that Bull Group have on Wednesday. Tell us what people can get if they sign up to the Bull Group, the updates if they become a member. Why should they do that?
Well, unlike the Conservative Party, the Bull Group has stayed true to the values of small C conservatism, and we are very much committed to continuing in that vein. So whatever the pressures from the media or the establishment classes or the Conservative Party or the Labour Party or whoever else, we will stay true to those values, the values that I've just discussed, and we will continue to make those cases in public forum. Next week, we have an event in Parliament, which will be one of the, just before Parliament goes into recess. So it'll be one of the last opportunities before that recess to make some points and to have some conversations about where the country needs to head, and obviously in the light of this Conservative leadership election, where that needs to go. And Anne Widdecombe, of course, is a figure that has spent her entire life advocating for small C Conservative values, had to switch parties out of principle at one point to do that and to get Brexit done. And because it's our 70th anniversary year, we're very excited to welcome Anne back to the Bull Group for our first post-pandemic event, and I think it will be a good get together and a great reflection of where the Conservative movement is.
Wonderful. Well, Ben, thank you for letting our viewers know about it. Thank you for your time this evening. I know you've been extremely busy with everything happening in Westminster and in the Conservative Party. So I do appreciate your time today, Ben, sharing your insights on what is happening in Westminster.
That's my pleasure, Peter.
And let me just finish off with our viewers. We will be back with you on Thursday. I think we'll be with Gard Ziegler, the latest dump from Hunter Biden's iPhone. Gard Ziegler set up Marco Polo, which is the one that actually had the iPhone when I went out and met him in DC 2 months ago, 6 weeks ago. So he'll be joining us to discuss what that means and the information they put out with their link with the Sun. So if you're interested in that over US side, state side, then do join us on Thursday for Gard Ziegler. And on that, I wish our viewers a wonderful rest of your evening, and hope you don't get too hot in this little mini wave that we are experiencing here in the UK, and look forward to seeing you on Thursday with Garrett. So thank you so much and good evening.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list, donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.